Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. We'll keep it short, you know the deal. If you enjoyed this or any one of our other episodes, go to realignment.supercast.com, $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership. You help us produce extra content like this, and you also get access to bonus episodes, Q&A with me and Sagar, and of course, community features that we're rolling out over the next few months. So once again, that's realignment.supercast.com. Help support the show, but also get access to the bonus features that we know you know and love. To kick this off, normally Q&A is reserved for people who have subscribed. They go to the Realignment Supercast and they could submit Ask Me Anything questions. But I actually just got a really good question on Instagram, which we haven't answered in forever. And the person says, "Hey, Marshall, love the show. What actually is a realignment? You guys haven't actually ever talked about that in a while, and maybe I missed it.
True.
So
but anyway, yeah.
Well, no, he's true though. Like, we haven't actually said, we've talked about the vibe and the direction, but I just kind of wanted to kick this off by discussing that. And just, I'll start by just reading the quick Wikipedia answer, because it's actually really useful. A political realignment in academic fields of political science and political history is a set of sharp changes in party ideology, issues, party leaders, regional and demographic bases of power of political parties, and the structure or rules of the political system, such as voter eligibility or financing. They can take 1 to 4 years, that being a realignment, or they can take 5 to 10 to 15 to 20 years. Now, we're going to be talking about Liz Cheney's loss in her GOP primary in Wyoming. We're going to mention George P. Bush, that is Jeb Bush's son's loss in his Texas attorney general primary a few months back. So obviously this definition of a realignment is really important. But Sagar, I'll just ask you, like, that's the academic definition. But for you, if you're thinking about this show, if you're thinking about your work at Breaking Points, like, what is a political realignment?
I mean, that's a pretty solid one. I just look at it as changes in the American electorate away from a previous era, entering into something new as it all shakes out. I think that's pretty spot on. Marshall, I know one of the things you want to talk about today is polling. I mean, I think that one of the most fascinating stories in American politics today is that polling is actually getting way worse. And what's really weird about that is polling was really good not that long ago, a decade ago in 2012, for those who may not remember. Nate Silver called every single state in the Electoral College, as well as the Senate map. His book, I forget what it was called, like The Signal and Noise, I want to say, became one of the top bestsellers in the country on Amazon, because people were like, oh my God, this is a wizard. Even I remember being like, wow, we're never going to not know who wins a presidential election again. I literally thought that. I also bought his book, you know. And 4 years later, what happened? Completely blown to shit. And then everybody's like, oh, okay, polling's fine now. We fixed it. We fixed all the issues. The polls were worse in 2020. I mean, I'll never forget ABC News, you know, it's not like a joke organization, has Wisconsin plus 17 for Joe Biden the day before the election. I think it came out to like maybe a couple of points, Marshall. I want to say within a couple hundred thousand votes for Trump. So now when I see polls plus, you know, 25 or whatever for John Fetterman over Dr. Oz, I was like, I don't know. Like, I don't believe that. Basically, the only thing I believe are actual results. And so, yeah, it's a very strange time. Like, you would think that all of these quote unquote sciences and all that will get better. But I think the truth is that Trump literally changed so much about American politics that even our polling models with nearly think about it. He's been around for a long time. Since 2015, he's been running for office. They still can't figure it out. I think that's the best example of a realignment.
Yeah, and basically that being the rules of the game that have set expectations and standards just no longer apply. We'll get into this too during another topic. That's why I'm introducing the show this way is, you know, ideas and what they mean and how saying one thing makes you identify one way. You kind of have this debate happen a bit when someone says, wow, it's crazy that the center left to left of the Democratic Party is talking about a more aggressive U.S. posture in the world when it comes to, let's say, Ukraine and Russia. let's say, with specifics around why exactly we're backing Taiwan. If someone's on the center left to left, they're probably much more likely to talk about democracy and those different bits. And usually you see this very annoying game, and what people do this on every single issue imaginable, where they say, look at what the left is. In the 1960s, they said X and it's crazy. Or they say things like, where's the anti-war left of the 2000s when it comes to Ukraine and China? And the reality is, as we are going through a realignment, that anti-war left no longer exists. That coalition no longer exists. And even those issues are no longer identified with the same figures and the same even context as one another. So that's just a really important way to really think about like a way that realignments are implementing themselves. Really don't be too focused on how the way those specific issues play out. Another way to think about this too is, and you see this happen all the time with Joe Rogan, for example. So there's this long-running discourse about when people will say, when Joe Rogan will say something, which frankly is conservative, is right-wing, in terms of the way our political valences are, whether that's a critique of Gavin Newsom in California, a commentary on COVID policy, any of those different bits. And then you'll see people coming back and saying, what are you talking about? Joe Rogan can't be on the right. He supported UBI. He supported universal healthcare. And back in 2016, those were political issues that were at the center of our political system. But right now, during a realignment moment, the defining political questions, and this isn't to say any one side is right or wrong on them, but they are just that during realignment moments, you're at a time when certain issues matter more than other ones. So if you tell me you are the most universal basic income, universal healthcare person ever, but you also tell me that you are, and I'm not saying this is Joe's position, you say you're completely anti-vax, you say that you think that the US spends way too much money overseas, this and that, I'm going to say, look, when it's the issues that are actually up for grabs this election, if you're frankly like talking about inflation or you want to see more oil and gas, I'm going to say, look, let's put your position on universal healthcare to the side, or let's lower it a bit and focus more on your position on these up for grab issues right now. Let's get to the first topic today then, which is Liz Cheney's loss. Liz Cheney was predictably, and she knew she was going to get blown out in her Wyoming GOP primary. She's obviously been in a difficult place with the GOP since she turned particularly anti-Trump, obviously voted to impeach President Trump. What are your thoughts, Sagar?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously predictable. The margin is pretty much within what was expected, blown out by about 40 points. I think the actual result is less interesting than the way that both she is handling it and a lot of people are trying to cope with the results. So I have two commentaries. One is I wrote an entire monologue about this already, but I'll go ahead and react to it for everybody. And this comes from John Bolton. So what did John Bolton say? Well, Bolton, his reaction to Liz Cheney's loss was, quote, Liz Cheney's loss diminishes our party. By putting her constitutional responsibilities above partisanship and political future, she deserves the highest possible praise. Attacks against Republicans based merely on disagreements about Trump must end. And here's my take.
One
which
quick
is,
thing, Sagar.
Yeah.
Because it's been a while. Who is John Bolton?
Oh,
and
God,
why does
yeah.
he really
former
matter?
Former national
context?
Security advisor to Donald Trump, neoconservative extraordinaire, George W. Bush's Secretary of the United Nations, I want to say, for a very brief, strange period in which he was, what was he? He was like appointed during a recess. He was like a
yeah,
recess
so
appointment because he would never actually get confirmed. Anyway.
The quick thing, and this is just like the nerd talking points. He is really not a neocon because remember,
oh, sorry,
the
yes.
neo. So this is why this sets up the debate about the future of the Republican Party.
Intervention.
John Bolton,
yeah,
John Bolton is a like. He's just like, let's bomb. Like, he's a very, very, very aggressive interventionist. He's not a guy. John Bolton in the 2000s was not waxing poetically about how we're going to give the Iraqis democracy. He is a very like hard power. The US is in, he's kind of like a, I don't want to say he's a realist because like that means something in international relations terms, but he's like, no, like we need to kick the shit out of Iran because Iran is a threat to America.
And
that was, and that's why he was so controversial during the Bush years, because he didn't even try to use the fig leaf of like democracy promotion and liberal internationalism, those different bits. But sorry,
go on. That's a good point. I was talking more in the way people would understand it. Okay, so that was what he said. And here was my response. I said, what Bolton and Cheney and so many others refuse to understand is that disagreements about Trump, which is what he said, Republicans need to stop attacking each other on, are actually the only thing that does matter in the GOP and to actual GOP primary voters. You are either fine with Trump or not. If not, you are not in the GOP. It is time to make peace with that. As I followed up, to be clear, that is descriptive analysis. I am not saying this is a good thing, but I am sick of the delusion. Now, the fairest reply is, but Brian Kemp. Here's my reply. Until you realize Brian Kemp still literally supports Trump in 2024, and to the extent that primary voters accepted Brian Kemp, it is because he never attacked Trump once in the primary. If you oppose Trump as the leader of the GOP, then you are simply not in the GOP. And I also want to address some spin that's currently been happening by Ben Shapiro. He put out a thread. He said, Liz Cheney fundamentally misunderstands why people are so passionately angry at her inside the GOP base, which is why she lost. She said that she would have required to go along with Trump's lie. Winning simply would have required her to act not as a front person for a Democratic committee dedicated to lumping all Republicans and conservatives with January 6 rioters. He follows up. Did Glenn Youngkin go along with the idea that Trump won the 2020 election? Did he go along with those efforts? How about Dan Crenshaw? What they didn't do is act as enthusiastic participants in a broader Democratic media agenda. Here is where Ben's spin is wrong, and this is his problem. Guess what? When the FBI raid happened, nobody asked him to. Glenn Youngkin came out and tweeted that this was unacceptable for the FBI to raid a former president. Dan Crenshaw also came out basically in opposition to the left. So my response would be, yeah, it's not just about stop the steal. It's about Trump the figure. Do you think that the left is a bigger threat than Trump the figure? Or do you, and therefore you are okay with Trump, even if you would prefer a Ron DeSantis or whatever, then you're a Republican if you think the left is the primary opponent. If you think Trump is a huge problem, huge enough for you not to vote and to come out, then you're just not a Republican. And that is why I find it mystifying that all these people cannot understand this. And there's just so much cope out there, Marshall. Like, you know, John Bolton saying our party. It's like, dude, you've been a Democrat now for a long time. And honestly, that's fine. I don't really know why people are finding it so difficult to just be like, for me, I'm like, yeah, I'm not a Republican. That's fine. I can't stand Trump. I genuinely cannot stand Trump. I also hate the woke left. Okay. You know, that is what it is. But it's just like, I'm not willing to be like, I hate the woke left so much and blah, 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 delude myself that because of, quote, his policies that I supported Trump, which is my personal favorite cope on all of this. Anyway, that's my reaction, which is that Liz Cheney is a Democrat today. Honestly, she'd probably do pretty well in a Democratic primary. I genuinely believe that. I think she'd probably get like 10% of the vote, something like that. Probably less than she would get in a Republican primary, or more than she would get in a Republican primary today. Go ahead.
You know what's funny about this? Couple different reactions. So number one, to you saying John Bolton is a Democrat, he doesn't even have to be a Democrat. John Bolton just needs to, all you are basically asking is that John Bolton let go of the fact that he is no longer the one of the so like think about the Republican Party. Pre-realignment. Mm-hmm. It's a three-legged stool. This is the metaphor. There's the leg, which are the foreign policy hawks, of which John Bolton was one of the leading lights. He's UN ambassador for a reason. There are the social conservatives, and then there are the fiscal low-tax conservatives. John Bolton was a leader of that group, and Liz Cheney was a leader of the foreign policy hawk group too. Now, right. I will say this about Liz Cheney. Liz Cheney is a, you know, obviously the daughter of a vice president. So she's coming from a political dynasty, but she is a, frankly, an impressive person. She is very smart for a politician. She has worked in the State Department. Like there are plenty of next generation successors to their parents. She's not Dan Quayle's son, Ben, who had one quick visit to the house after the Tea Party wave. So if you're looking at John Bolton and looking at Liz Cheney, this is so hard for them because it's not even like they're the Lincoln Project guys who are just operatives, right? Like they're operatives. They are the help. Like that's what they really exist to do. Liz Cheney and John Bolton were at the top of the pyramid. What they said went on foreign policy, and it's very tough to give that up. But during a realignment, whether or not people are right or wrong, certain groups get left behind.
Right.
The Rockefeller Republicans, you know what?
Yeah.
John Lindsay, mayor of New York, Nelson Rockefeller himself. Nelson Rockefeller can't even run for, he's made Gerald Ford's vice president. He can't even join the reelection team in 1976 because that wing of the party lost it.
Yeah, they kicked his ass out. They're like, we don't want anything to do with you. And he was one of the top figures. Yeah.
Governor of New York, like a very impressive person, was a major Republican candidate in the 1960s. What's happening with Liz and John is that they are just having to reckon. Well, look, let me put it this way, Sagar. John Bolton like knows what's going on. I think John Bolton knows what's going on. Right. He's saying what he's going to say. John Bolton is not launching a group, but Liz Cheney is forming a new anti-Trump group. And to quote the Wall Street Journal, she's also pondering a presidential bid. So here's what I'm interested in. Let me give you the scenario and I want to hear your response. If you are Liz Cheney, I think in good faith, she actually believes what she believes about Trump. Obviously, there's ego. There's always different bits. But like at a core level, what makes Elise Stefanik different than Liz Cheney, they're both hyper-ambitious, inherently self-absorbed politicians. But for Liz Cheney, because remember, the key thing is Elise Stefanik took Liz Cheney's position. Liz Cheney was going to be Speaker of the House someday. And that's all gone. And she did that over Trump. Because remember, and you know, there are a bunch of Democrats who are already preemptively angry that Liz Cheney's getting a lot of praise. Liz Cheney actually, as I understand it, there have been years where she voted with Trump more than Elise Stefanik did. This is why this goes to your monologue point, Sagar, of, you know what? It's not whether you're a 94 or 89. I would even wager, man, that in today's political system, even a 70 with Trump would get you there as long as you are with the one question,
no question,
that Trump cares about. Trump doesn't care if you like weren't quite there for the Border Adjustment Tax Act of 2018. Yep. He cares if I get attacked, will you come out swinging? Which is what Elise Stefanik did. And that's how she, as a very moderate Republican, in terms of her voting record, actually went harder to the right than Liz Cheney, who's actually pretty conservative.
Elise Stefanik is one of the only 14 Republicans in the entire Congress who voted against Trump's border wall. She voted for the Equality Act in 2019. She was basically pretty squishy on abortion up until Roe versus Wade. I can go fully down the line in terms of all of the things that she supposedly represented the dead consensus. She, to date, is the only politician who Donald Trump has said could be president in 2028. As his heir. So you take that for what you will. Now, why do you think he likes Elise Stefanik? Personally, I don't think she's that good on television, but he likes it. Whenever she goes out and she's like, we're going after the corrupt Democrats on January 6th, political persecution. Listen, I respect the game and I understand what matters, which is Trump. And I get why a lot of people really hate this, because anything else that you care about basically just doesn't matter. And guess what? I care about a lot of stuff, but I'm just not going to sit here and lie to people and tell them that any of it matters to the extent that Trump matters. He overshadows everything. Look at this Trump FBI raid. Look at how every single one of these 2024 so-called challengers comes rushing to his defense. DeSantis bends the knee. Pompeo bends the knee. Glenn Youngkin bends the knee. Personally, if I was Trump, I would have announced last week. The day after the raid, I would have announced. I think he's a fool. Every day he waits, he's... power only goes down, even though he's still extraordinarily powerful. He's the undisputed leader. All the current polling says that Trump has actually solidified his GOP base.
Poll, which was like, do you support Trump? Yes or no? He's up 4 points from last
week. That's what I'm saying. It's like, this is the best time ever. Now, by the way, is that good for the national GOP? No, it's actually not. And this is the funny thing.
Well, why not?
Well, people have, Josh Barrow actually replied this to me. He goes, yeah, you're right. And he goes, but the problem with that is that now the GOP is like having to contest Arizona for a third cycle. I'm like, I didn't say this is good. Like, I'm not enjoying this state of affairs. There's no reason why Arizona should be up for grabs. But a Trumper would say, yeah, guess what? We also sent Ohio. Now Ohio is now a red state. In 2004, it wasn't. Wisconsin is now a swing state. Pennsylvania is now a swing state. Georgia, I mean, shouldn't be a swing state, but you trade, you know, the entire so-called blue wall from 2016. It's pluses and minuses, folks. Like, and I just think a lot of people need to take their own personal emotion out of it. I'm not saying, like I said, I don't enjoy things being this way. I just simply am looking at the world and I'm like, okay, 80% of the people who voted for Donald Trump who are in Congress are either retiring or getting kicked out of office. You tell me whose party it is. There's just no way of grappling with that.
And this gets to, I'll give my answer, then I want to hear your answer, like what I think Liz Cheney should do. Like, I think, once again, this is political advice, not like a pure like prescriptive where I think Liz Cheney's greatest thing since sliced bread. Like, I think given the outpouring and frankly, given how weak the Democratic Party's bench is, like if you're Liz Cheney, you shouldn't think of yourself as, because sorry, we talked about this earlier. She's talking about, you know, how in her concession speech, she's like comparing herself to Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
She's comparing herself to Ulysses S. Grant. And like, guess what? Politicians are politicians. That's just what you do. Like that's like, yes, unself-aware, strange. Like whatever. Like this is what politicians do. If you're playing at the level that she, if you are number three in the House, you are grandiose and you're going to speak that way. So whatever. But if she actually is going to think about this strategically, she should not think of herself as those figures. She should think of herself as Ronald Reagan. Here's what I mean by that. Like Ronald Reagan, until basically the late 1950s, was a Democrat. And not just like, I'm an actor, I'm a Democrat. He was a Hollywood union leader who was a very active, like explicit, like Democrat. And over time, he starts to change. And in 1964, he gives a famous speech, which effectively launches his political career, changes from being like, oh yeah, Reagan, like, it's kind of funny. Like up until like, even in the 1960 campaign, he was still technically like a Democrat. He's like part of the Democrats for Nixon thing. He gives a speech in 1964 and the speech is called It's a Time for Choosing. And if you are Liz Cheney, what Liz Cheney needs to do is basically in 2024, instead of running for president, instead of launching some weird third party thing, she should actually say, no, like guys, it's a time for choosing. I think Trump is the worst thing ever. Choose whatever it is against Trump that could actually win. And guess what? She could move to Virginia. She could move to plenty of states. Like she's frankly, people have always dunked on her for this. She's basically more from Virginia than she was even from Wyoming.
She's from here, funny, where I live.
Yeah. There's this funny dunk where when she announced her Wyoming Senate run in 2014, the geotech was sent from Alexandria, Virginia. So she could give that speech and she could say like, look, I was always a Republican, but the Republican Party left me. That's what Ronald Reagan said. And guess what? The thing that made Reagan's move not cynical was it was actually true. Yeah. In the 1940s with FDR, Ronald Reagan is a Democrat. In the 1960s with Barry Goldwater versus LBJ, Ronald Reagan is frankly a Republican.
Well, it's worth spending some time on Reagan. Why did he become a Republican? People should understand this. Well, it's just like that. He started out as a Democrat. He didn't think too deeply about politics. His union experience, he was the president of the Screen Actors Guild, made him actually become involved, not involved, but exposed to a lot of communists. And eventually what happened is he's like, yeah, I don't really know about these commies, blah, blah, blah. HUAC, you know, the House Un-American Affairs Committee and all of that starts their investigations and he gets started to be asked about his associations with communists. And he actually is like, hey, you know, this McCarthy guy, this guy has a good point. And eventually he starts coming around to, at that time, the central question in American politics was, it was basically like, do you think that communism is the biggest threat to the United States, the world order, the global order, or you don't? And a lot of people on the left of center in American politics did not. There were legitimate communists. But beyond that, it's like people saw some of the people on the left of center saw the McCarthy, kind of the McCarthy witch hunt as un-American. But a lot of the country didn't. And he fell on the other side, which is what put him oppositional to what was the establishment, not just of the left, but really of the right, too, because the secret is that Dwight D. Eisenhower and many other Republicans hated McCarthy. And Reagan just became sympathetic to that, which ultimately leads to his time for choosing speech. It is fine to change. Yeah, go ahead.
And the key thing too is, because I like the way you set this up, because like that's his 50s awakening, right? Like the question of like communism and the response to it. The second half of that story, which leads him to the 60s, is his movie career basically fades out and he becomes a spokesman for GE, General Electric Theater, which was, and this is such like 1950s, like, bullshit. This would never happen today.
But
like, you know, GE basically, like they have a TV show, which is literally just like a commercial where it's like skits and stories, but they're all basically built around like Ronald Reagan as this spokesman for, hey, like the look at the power of American industry. Look at how the free market has given you this wonderful GE dishwasher. Like, think of the famous, like, you know, debate between Nikita Khrushchev and Richard Nixon when he's VP in 1959, where he's like, look, compared to the Soviet kitchen, the American kitchen is 10 times superior. And that is the type of thing which actually means something if you're in the consumerist 50s. The point is, he does this show and he starts to become more right on economic questions. So Sagar, it's not just the question was about communism. Mm-hmm. In the 60s, because JFK was decently conservative on like those economic questions. By LBJ's time, it comes to the size of government. Right. So Reagan famously does recordings for the American Medical Association against socialist medicine. So by that time, if it's 1964, so he, to your point, like he's red-pilled in today's parlance, by like the question of McCarthyism and communism, but he's finalized by like, oh shoot, like, if it's 1964, the actual question that's actually being debated here is, should government get bigger or should it go back to the way it used to be? Because he thinks Eisenhower has made it too big. He thinks Eisenhower is a squish. This is why he's with Goldwater. So like, yeah. So like, once again, like what I am advising in podcast sense, Liz Cheney to do is, if she wants to be pretentious and grandiose, you could be the Democratic version of Reagan. The field is that weak. Liz Cheney. And because here's the thing too, the reasons why Democrats like don't like her, the Iraq war, various statements, those are not up for grabs right now. Like the 2008 election, Hillary probably lost. A huge reason why Hillary lost and she was vulnerable is because she was for the Iraq war and Obama was very aggressively in favor of it. The 2020, The 2028 Democratic primary is not going to be decided on the fact that Liz Cheney was in the State Department in Iraq. Liz Cheney could very easily say, hey, look, here's the deal. You need your like Democratic Margaret Thatcher. You need like an Iron Lady to stand up against these crazies who kicked me out. Like that's a better argument than what I'm sure she is likely to do, which is just this weird kamikaze run, which will get her a book deal. But I don't know, man. Like I genuinely don't understand the urge to kamikaze oneself. It's a very weird. It's weird.
Yeah, I don't really get it. I'm going to be honest with you. Like, I just, the whole thing, I'm trying not to be too cynical, but it's a great way to get famous. It's a great way to make a lot of money. I mean, look, I think she is already independently wealthy, but you know, as somebody on television, there are a lot of people in this business who really enjoy being on TV. They really enjoy being at the center. I mean, look, it's certainly possible that that is a major motivation. She'll certainly get us. And I don't even mean this in the money context, but like she'll be a most frequent guest on CNN and MSNBC now for years. Like she'll actually be in the quote unquote meta capital C conversation as a result of her loss, kind of in the way that Claire McCaskill is. Or some other famous senators that are always on television. So she's effectively guaranteed that. I mean, look at Adam Kissinger. The guy basically made the same trade-off. So this isn't even about monetary. It's more about a gamble of, I will have more of a say on American politics by kamikazing myself. I honestly think it could be a very strong motivation outside of any monetary concern.
The one thing I would say, because I don't think it's monetary, because like, I just don't think this is monetary for her. I genuinely think the difference between Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger is that Liz Cheney was going to be Speaker of the House someday. Liz, there was a world, if Jeb Bush had become president, there was a world where Liz Cheney became president herself. She is still thinking in those means. And I think, you know, like I mentioned this in a different episode, but, you know, I'm listening to Splendid in the Vial. It's about Churchill during the Blitz. And he has this quote where he's like, it's behind you somewhere. Yeah. Eric Larson, he's talking to his son Randolph. And I think it's during like 1941. And he's like, I think I finally see a way through. And that way through is the U.S. getting involved in the war. And a way through means beating Nazi Germany. I think Liz Cheney, unlike Adam Kinzinger, genuinely, for whatever reason, thinks there's a way through. That could be the wrong way through, right? Like Churchill was analytically correct, but I think that's where it comes into it. I want to add one quick other topic here, because I've talked a lot of crap about the following person, but I think it's important to praise people when they do what I say they should basically do. So last week, Tulsi Gabbard hosted, filled in for Tucker Carlson on his show on Friday. And this caused a lot of Twitter controversy. And everyone's like, how could Tulsi do this? She's still technically a fellow at the Sanders Institute, which is Bernie Sanders' fake think tank, which I think is just wild. And the fact that she's still on that just shows how fake it is. But, you know, she was a, vice chair of the DNC. She runs in 2020, Democratic member of Congress, obviously, which she's hosting for Tucker. And you know what? Like, at first, my urge was to be like, there goes Tulsi making it all about herself. But I'm like, wait a second. She's just doing the binary thing. Mm-hmm. Like, on foreign policy issues, Tulsi Gabbard is very aligned with the rising right. And she's been there for a while. Like, it's funny.
Well, with the Tucker right. Let's just call it the Tucker right.
The extent
rising, I think, is very in dispute. So,
well, anyway. I want you to follow up on that in a second. But like for the Tucker right, which is a real portion of the GOP, I would say this portion of the right has more energy than the John Bolton portion of the right, is the way I'd put it. Like in 2015, like people are like, why is Tulsi Gabbard going to visit Bashar al-Assad during the war in Syria? Because he's literally like a war criminal. And she's doing that visit because she literally makes this argument. She says the only thing that matters is stopping Islamic terrorism. And she specifically attacked Obama from the right for not being as aggressive enough on questions of Islamic terror. So think of that argument. Like, that argument very much fits. Like, she's not interested in democracy promotion. She's not talking about like foofy, like human rights. She's just like, all that matters is that America wins. America goes home and we keep people safe. Like, that's a compelling, that's a compatible argument. She's doing monologues on how our policy against Russia and Ukraine isn't working. She's talking about the sanctions, how Ukraine is going to lose. Like, all that is very compatible with Tucker's version of the GOP. So, you know what? Like, good for Tulsi, that she realizes that, you know, like, doing the squishy thing and trying to play 5D chess just like, doesn't work. Like, Bannon invited her to interview for an admin position for a reason in 2016. And I just think that it would be healthier for our political system if more politicians with major followings, like, she obviously hasn't come out and said like, I'm a Republican. I think it's going to happen at some point. She's also been very aggressive on, you know, LGBTQ trans issues especially. And I'm sure the overturning of Roe v. Wade is probably like not a good thing for her, because I'm sure she would have liked to just say that issue isn't up for grabs right now. But I think it would be healthier if more politicians in our system just were like, look, like, real talk, in terms of the issues we're facing today, if I'm running for something, if I'm trying to be ambitious, I'm not talking about bystanders. Guys, I'm a Republican. I'm going to host Tucker. I'm not going to pretend that I'm a Democrat still.
But here's why I would disagree and why I don't think she is a Republican, which is that Tucker, while having a very distinct foreign policy, also is still willing to basically back Donald Trump, even though there is absolutely zero evidence that Trump would frankly not handle Ukraine way worse from his perspective than Biden. I mean, I will personally say, I think Biden is far more restrained than Donald Trump would be in office. And my evidence for that is that Trump was far more hawkish on, you know, this is the hilarious part about fucking Ukrainegate, which is that at the end of the day, Trump sent the missiles in 2019. Obama wouldn't do it in 2015. the Trump administration delivered on John McCain's wildest dreams on Ukraine at an actual policy level. He also just happened to be a fucking moron and was like, hey, it'd be great if you would investigate Hunter Biden. Like, but here's the thing. He still did it. He actually did. So on a policy perspective, this is why I just don't, I disagree, because I think Tulsi genuinely does care about the anti-interventionism, but, and look, this is why I just don't think this is rising at all. By the way, I align myself far more with what both of them think on Ukraine, but I'm just not going to delude myself into thinking that just because the number one cable news host happens to say something, every single Republican in the U.S. Senate is backing the Biden policy. The only people in the Senate who dissent from the Biden policy on Ukraine are Republicans who want him to be more hawkish. Now, you can tell, say, Rand Paul to me all you want, but Rand Paul and Josh Hawley, while yes, they are part of the quote unquote right, there is no constituency out of literally those two individuals that exists in the entire party.
Well, here's the thing. I wouldn't say Rand Paul. I would say J.D. Vance, Blake Masters.
Okay, he's not in the Senate.
Joe Kent.
And let's see. Let's see. Okay. First of all three of those people actually need to win. Things not looking so good for Blake right now. Joe Kent, I have no idea how that district works. I will not pretend to. I think it's a top two jungle primary.
It is.
I think it's a GOP thing.
It's top. Yeah. It's he made it through. He beat.
So he made it in the top two, but I'm saying I don't know how it works in terms of the head to head. I don't know anything about it. By the way, also, that's a fucking backbenching congressman. Sorry. Nobody cares. Like, if there is an actual constituency in the United States Senate, of which there is, to send more weapons to Ukraine than the Biden administration, that exists within the GOP. And to date, I have seen zero evidence that voters are willing to punish someone for specifically having the, quote, wrong position on foreign policy. I don't think people give a shit either way in the GOP primary. Personally, and I think if Trump were to ever come to office, I think it'll be 10 times. I mean, look at what the guy was saying during the war. And this is always where I get very frustrated with people who still support him, you know, Tucker and all this other. He's like, oh, we should paint the plane so they look like China and get the two of them into a war. It's like this shit is crazy. You know, it's like this shit is actually crazy. Like, I honestly fear for my life if Donald Trump is the person who's handing Ukraine. And I'm willing to say that because I actually care about these things. But a lot of these people who kiss his ass won't say that. They'll both be like,
yeah. Do you take him seriously then? Like, no, I know he wouldn't literally paint them. Like, I think what they would say to you is, come on, Sagar, he's like Trump, he's being funny. Like, what do you say to them?
I mean, he almost shot down an Iranian jetliner with people on it and then called it off at the last minute. I mean, like, I believe he was the president. Like, I take Trump seriously. I think he's the president. I think he makes the call. I have 4 years of evidence to say that never at any point in his administration did he ever stand up to the quote-unquote establishment, neocon, or whatever. In fact, there's quite a bit of evidence that he got rolled every single time that he said he wanted to. And to the extent that he reined in the deep state, I don't see a lot of evidence for that. I mean,
from what I heard,
he greenlit some of the most provocative projects inside. I mean, he killed Qasem Soleimani. You know, I mean, I can go down the list in terms of all of the things that Trump actually did. When Trump tells me that he would be big and strong, I mean, look, there's a report that Trump told Vladimir Putin that he would bomb Moscow if they invaded Ukraine. I mean, I don't know if that's true. Like, you know,
say we want about Joe Biden. Joe Biden would not do that.
He didn't say that. I mean, listen, Joe, I was very critical of Joe when he said, by God, this man cannot remain in power. I mean, that's not the same thing as saying I'm going to fucking bomb the Kremlin. I mean, and, you know, and then this is where I'm sure the Trumper is listening to this. Like, oh, you never heard of Nixon and the Madman? I'm just going to say I believe that Richard M. Nixon was several standard deviations smarter, more considered, more principled. And I genuinely do mean that than Donald Trump was, having studied the actual Richard Nixon. So, yeah, I mean, what I get most frustrated by the anti-interventionists who support Trump is that they're full of shit. Like, if you're an actual anti-interventionist, Trump is not an anti-interventionist. It just doesn't exist. So just
look, here's what's actually happening here, because you and I, like, know these circles. What's actually happening is that people see Trump as a opportunity. What they would say is they support Trump, but wait, put it this way.
It's been 4 years. Like, That's my thing. It's been for, it happened already. We literally, it already happened. Where's the opportunity? Like, at a certain point,
you don't think the GOP is more anti-interventionist than it was?
Only in rhetoric. I don't see any evidence on policy that it exists. Zero. Afghanistan was the proof. I mean, look, Trump did not get out of Afghanistan. Sure. I mean, look, I supported his peace deal with the Taliban, but all current evidence to me says that Trump probably would have violated said peace deal because he didn't ultimately even begin the drawdown after he was leaving office. And given the fact that they're all like, oh, all these weapons we left behind and these 600 American citizens who, by the way, not a single one of them was killed, just so we're all clear, in terms of all the people who said that they were leaving it behind and risking their lives. All of them got out who did want to. So all I'm going to say is, if I'm going to believe you, if he was going to respond to that media environment, then we would continue to be at war in Afghanistan and probably several hundred more American troops would die because it'd be weapons free from the Taliban. Maybe you support that. I don't. So what I'm saying is, I don't think that the GOP is more anti-intervention. I mean, one guy voted against NATO expansion. One guy out of the entire thing. That's not evidence to me. And also, I mean, I would love this. I would love to see someone. By the way, anybody who's in Ohio or Arizona, go ask Blake and JD and Joe Kent what they think about NATO. I'd love to hear that response. Now, they probably won't answer because it doesn't.
I'll say it. Joe Kent would vote against Joe Kent would vote against NATO expansion.
Okay.
I 100%
bet
he would.
Because I don't want to talk bad about the guy without.
I definitely think Joe Kent would vote against NATO expansion. I don't know about JD. Honestly, I don't know.
If I was JD, I don't know if I would vote against NATO expansion because there's a bunch of Ukrainians who live in Ohio. Like, yeah, I think that'd be a tough one for Blake. Blake's already in a tough spot. He's down 5 in Arizona. Mark Kelly is like the hero astronaut. He's getting pounded right now on abortion. The last thing the guy needs is to be seen as extreme in any way. I mean, look, I mean, I think if I were to personally ask Blake on a 1-to-1, if he supported, he probably would say no, but I don't know how he would vote. This is what I'm trying to point. And by the way, even if the both did, that's still only 3. Like, this is where I just get really frustrated with a lot of wish casting of an online movement into actual policy. There is no evidence that Donald Trump would be more anti-interventionist in the conflicts that we supposedly care about than a Joe Biden. So I really just don't know how people can reconcile themselves with that.
You know, I think once again, like you said, you've done your bit to tick off the right Trump online portion of the audience here. Look, I'll just lay it out here. Sagar is giving you all a really straightforward rubric, which is the lesson of 4 years of Trump, from my perspective, given what you're saying, Sagar, is don't look at the rhetoric. Because you could say things like, oh, okay, this is actually helpful. Knowing that Donald Trump saying that the Iraq war is a mistake and that forever wars suck is so baseline that it doesn't actually help for you answer the underlying question. So you can say, look, it was a genuine innovation in 2015 for him to say the Iraq war is a mistake because you still had, like, he supported it in 2003. He changed his position, but him saying that, that's an example of political bravery, but it was also his intuition about it. But that was the correct call. But the question of if we could go back in time, would we invade Iraq is actually different from, well, it's 2017. There are reports that Bashar al-Assad has used chemical weapons. Am I going to strike his Air Force? Because Trump struck his Air Force
twice.
Right. It's different to say, and I'll be frank, I support both those strikes. But once again, if you're Tulsi Gabbard, I guess this goes to your point, Tulsi Gabbard would not have launched those strikes.
No, and she criticized them. And also Tucker criticized them, but Tucker also supports Trump. Right.
It also doesn't answer to your point too, like, you know, killing Qasem Soleimani, something that I think in retrospect I also support. You know, he's a guy who literally played a direct role in killing hundreds of Americans in Iraq and all those other different bits. At the end of the day, like, that is not having, it has nothing to do with the question of was Iraq a good idea.
You know what's funny though? Even Soleimani is a great example. So Marshall, yeah, look, a dead man should have been dead in 2006. Honestly, I think the case for killing him was great in 2006.
We'd had multiple right. chances over the years, and Trump finally is like, right. let's push the button.
But the correct point, and actually this is why I always am deeply distrustful of Trump on a foreign policy stage. There was no reason to do it at that time. He just did it. Like, it's one of those things where Bolton and Pompeo were making this case, and it just came out of nowhere as a result of it. It's kind of like the Pelosi trip to Taiwan. It's like, conceptually, okay, we can all discuss, but it's like, was there a strategy? This is the thing with Trump. He doesn't think about anything. He just does it. He's incredibly susceptible. And look, I mean, as people were going to get mad at hearing this, but I saw the truth. He's deeply insecure, deeply wants like establishment people around him in order to stroke his ego. And the people who know that best are Mike Pompeo and John Bolton. I mean, these guys used to kiss his ass in a way you cannot even imagine, because they had discrete policy aims. And the truth is that anybody who is really good at kissing Trump's ass can get anything they want done in his White House. Ask Gary Cohn. Ask Jared Kushner. Mr. Tough on Crime is the biggest jailbreak president in modern history. That's Donald Trump, because his son-in-law's father was locked up for like tax evasion or whatever.
Oh, no.
I mean, yeah. It wasn't what did tax he do again? Evasion. No, he blackmailed his brother
yeah, with a like, hooker over like, yeah, it was right. Tax evasion was putting that very lightly.
Right. But this is what I'm trying to say, which is that when you actually look close and look, I know this can sound sanctimonious and all of that. And there are a lot of people out there who tell themselves things like, oh, I support Trump because of the policies. They're like, I'm just like, you're full of shit. I genuinely believe that you're full of shit. And I know that that's very hurtful for you to hear. But the truth is that you probably just hate the left. And I think that's fine. I just wish people were honest about it. Like, it's fine. It's a perfectly fine position to hold. Saw this
people hate the
Twitter.
Right. Like, people, and this is a
polarized
moment.
Yeah, a lot of people hate the right off. Yeah, exactly. A lot of people
hate the right. People hate each other right now.
ask these people on the Liz Cheney thing why they like Liz Cheney. They fucking hate the right. Okay, say it. Just say it. Fine. It's okay. Don't talk about democracy. You just hate Republicans. Fine. This is the, like, I really like to strip away all this stuff just because the level of bullshit that we're all forced to imbibe on this is just maddening. Anyway, that's it.
Speaking of maddening, I'd like to we didn't do a discussion in the aftermath of Nancy Pelosi's trip to Taiwan, but you know, Ed Markey and a couple members of Congress showed up. I just would just love to, and look, my position on this, like, you know, per the Josh Rogan Breaking Point segment I did, was, like you said, there wasn't a strategy. The thing that I'm just increasingly concerned about is, I think the Biden administration, the policy calls they're making are ones I support, but my consistent critique since basically the intel dumps at the start of the war of Ukraine has been they really are just not articulating or preparing Americans for the war that they're going into. I'm sorry you missed this one. It was during Breaking Point scheduling, but I did this great episode with Tobias Harris. It's either coming out after or before this episode. It's about Shinzo Abe, and he talked about a speech which Shinzo Abe gave in 2007, where he literally said, quote, "My vision, my purpose is to prepare Japan for the rising waves of the next 50 to 100 years, which is just awesome, right? Like, I love that shit. Like, I love, like, the Gaullism. I love, like, the vision. I think that's taking grandiosity and putting it in the right direction, right? Like, okay, this is actually a quick thing, quick sidebar. When we were talking earlier about, Liz Cheney comparing herself to, you know, Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant, my beef with her is that I have yet to see her actually articulate a vision for the country or a deeper argument that matches the heights that she's raising herself to. So, like, and what's like, if you say, look, if you're gonna compare yourself to Lincoln, then give us something. Because right now we're getting like standard fare, like, Trump is a threat to democracy. And to be frank for a second, like, there are plenty of people who I think would be more effective, like conveyors of that message, given that point. But back to back to the Biden thing, real quick, but to the Shinzo Abe thing. Like Shinzo Abe is like, look, my purpose is to like get Japan ready for the chaos that's to come. Like we are in a new world. There was an old Japan. We need a new Japan. This is the theme of the episode. The Biden administration's inability to say like, look, there is this world, whether it was the Cold War, whether it was like 20 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, that's the old world. Here is this new world. This new world is one where, look, like we are going to antagonize China. We're going to antagonize China. They are going to threaten us. There is going to be like risk. And we think it's worth it because of this, and that. And don't wake up every other week being like, wait, holy crap, the Chinese are saying this could mean war. The lack of preparedness for this and the lack of just like an overall worldview beyond just like this like obvious like, oh, you know, like autocracy versus democracy bit is just like deeply frustrating to me.
Yeah, but this is my pushback, Marshall, and this is why I was against almost all the current U.S. support to Ukraine, which is that autocracy, democracy is the only language that these people speak. By the way, just so everybody knows, Ukraine's so-called counteroffensive is not going so well. So despite the fact that we shipped them all these weapons, their actual ability to combat, offensively take back ground has completely failed outside of a few precision strikes in Crimea. So that's not working. Number two, the U.S. Department of Defense just testified before Congress saying that our stock of Javelin missiles is down by one third because we shipped them all to Ukraine. And that if we wanted to, that we cannot replace them because of supply chain problems should China invade Taiwan. Now, I know you've pushed back, but the basic point is that a massive part of the U.S. defense supply chain has been dedicated and now disrupted and stripped in order to support the war in Ukraine effort, which frankly, they're not doing that good of a job of right now, not to mention political corruption that's happening in Ukraine. So I think if China invades Taiwan, we're going to find out very, very much the hard way that there isn't very much that we can really do about it as a result of a lot of our dedication to the Ukrainian war effort from an actual military hardware perspective. And then we are going to have to be forced to make act. Look, I speak in the language of national interests and of hard power and echo. And I know people get upset about this, but look, the truth is that when Taiwan falls, or if Taiwan falls, and 92% of the world's most advanced chips get folded off the market, the U.S. economy essentially crumbles and GDP will contract here by untold amounts, not to mention what chaos will involve in the Asia Pacific. The fate of Kyiv just had nothing to do with that. Now, I'm not saying it wasn't a good thing in order to support them, but the inability in order to discuss things in the manner of which I am, outside of some emotional connection to like Ukraine and things on Twitter, is going to bite us in the ass. And I think that we'll all find out very, very much the hard way, as many people behind me did, that it will be a deeply, deeply clarifying moment and will reveal like a lot of the bullshit rhetoric that we have been fed, not just on Ukraine, on so many different things. Because, you know, it's interesting. We talked about this maybe one of our last episodes about George Kennan, The Wise Men. Let's recommend that book. What is it called? Wise Men in the World They Made,
Thomas and Walter Isaacson, The Wise Men, Six Friends of the World They Made, post-1945. It's about building the post-war order.
Yeah. Those men went through deeply traumatic times where they had to make all of these discrete choices. And they saw hundreds of thousands of people, of their own citizens, not to mention many millions of people across the world killed, across three wars, World War I, World War II, and the Korean War, of which they also had to update NSC 68 and the containment strategy. I think that's frankly just what it takes. And I just think a lot of this rhetoric and all this stuff, we are all going to find out the hard way. And, you know, this is a credit to Shinzo Abe. I think he'll be like a Churchillian type figure, although he was cut, you know, short, which is that he saw what was coming. That's why he wanted to amend the Japanese constitution. That's why he wanted to have a much stronger Japan. But I just think we're going to look back at some of the choices that we made and we're going to rue the day for it. And I think that's deeply unfortunate.
Yeah, I think to respond to that, I'd say a couple of things. So one, I agree with you that New York Times economist Boyle, let me put it this way, like autocracy versus democracy to me is like a first step in defining like what this actual moment is.
Oh, see, I think it should be the fourth, fifth step. No, but it should all be national interest.
Yeah. But this is my thing. Like, I think the number one thing you need to do in an environment like this is actually like define who your opponents are, and frankly, just like what the contrast is. The key thing here. And look, let's put aside Russia for a second, because this is where you and I like just 100% disagree. Focusing on China. China is a country which is an autocratic dictatorship with deep ambitions to fundamentally change our ways of life.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
That is why.
Wait, and let's just extend that. And the capacity to do so. I think that's the most important.
Fair.
Yeah.
Like, there is nothing the matter with defining terms that way. I think the starting, let me put it this way. If it's the 1930s, and this isn't where you think it is, so don't worry. If it's the 1930s, obviously the United States needs to arm, Britain needs to arm, Britain needs to be ready. But the starting point should have been, and I think was, the Nazis are autocratic revanchists who want to shift the post-World War I order towards Germany. That's autocracy versus democracy. So that's why I'm just saying, like, let's separate Russia from it. I think it's perfectly reasonable to say, just as in the Cold War, it's basically like free market, like liberal capitalism versus communism. That's the first step. And the critique I will buy from you is that you're on the anti-interventionist, like alt-center is how I would describe you politically. Like, you are not ultimately like in the Biden administration. Like, you're not who the Biden administration needs to like convince of things. I genuinely think a Democratic voter whose mind is shaped by the Iraq War, Afghanistan going for a long time, those different bits, needs to have these ideas like open-mindedly articulated in their way. So if there's a critique of Biden that I'll take, it's that it's easy to talk about autocracy versus democracy, but it doesn't really mean anything. And to your point, it's kind of funny, like Tobias Harris, actually his critique of autocracy versus democracy, if this episode hasn't come out before this, his beef with the term is that that's actually not our objective, because that doesn't explain why we are effectively allying ourselves with Vietnam and the Philippines, because those are not democracies.
That's why I don't even start there.
But here's the thing though. Here's his starting position though. His starting position is the U.S. objective in the Asia Pacific is to protect the sovereignty of free nations. That's his. And once again, you disagree with that too, but that's his starting organizing.
I think the U.S.
principle.
Objective in the Asia Pacific should be to protect the U.S. economy, and that's why we're willing to deal with communist Vietnam, who we literally fought a war against. By the way, I don't give a shit. I don't care.
Yeah, no, Tobias Harris. But this is my point, though. Like,
yeah.
Tobias Harris is at the center for American progress.
Right? I'll
put it this way. If you want a real portion of like the center left to left to get on board a like US rebalancing policy, whether it's like defense spending, those different bits.
See, I don't think that's possible.
I think their brains
have been rotted. No, I think their brains have been rotted. And I think Ukraine is the true example of that. I think the thought leaders in the Democratic Party, the New York Times and all that, are so unable to see the world through the lens of national interest and through any sort of actual hard power that, and by the way, I don't think that the right is either susceptible either. And this is why there will be a clarifying moment. Yeah.
Question though, then why, I guess this is where I'm just objecting, where, because my objection comes down to, I think you don't like how they are getting there, but like Ed Markey is like
green. There.
Why not? We passed. Well,
going to Taiwan, who cares?
Going to Taiwan and making this a political issue is actually like the first step.
Well, no, I meant for a backbencher senator. No, by the way, I disagree with that. People have been going to Taiwan for the last 30 years, so it has never led.
Not with China. Ed Markey has no position of authority.
He's simply doing this.
But it's Ed Markey following up Nancy Pelosi's trip, where the Chinese are being incredibly aggressive during this moment. So, like,
I think that's fine.
Let me put it this way, right? Like, we've talked a bit about the javelin replenishment and those different bits, and like, look, that's the defense. Like, industrial chain, like all that stuff was like incredibly valuable. Going to do some episodes on that. Like, I don't disagree with you on that point, but like my point is the way that you actually build a sustainable governing coalition against Chinese aggression is not by the way, is you are a part of the coalition. You're focused on like economic interests. Democrats are not going to be, many Democrats are not going to get on board the Taiwan coalition because of semiconductors. They're just not. Like, that's not how this works.
Well, that's fine. And then, but I don't think the timeline really all that matters, because that just takes so long that by the time, this is what I mean by clarifying, we will have a global crisis. I don't know if it will be in Taiwan. It's still, by the way, people still sleep on North Korea. I still believe that that's a tinder box just waiting to explode. I still have no idea. And don't forget, the Chinese are aligned with the North Koreans. That's another important thing to
not forget too, is that, and this is what makes the Ukraine war different than the Taiwanese war. The honest question, and the Japanese actually just released a statement on this. The Japanese specifically stated that this is like a new defense statement, they would specifically consider a Chinese invasion of Taiwan to represent a direct like emergency threat. The leader of the French Navy, the head admiral, has specifically stated that the French Navy would be positioned to fight with allies for Taiwan.
Yeah, sure. All right.
Well, but once
they
again,
can say like, whatever they want. They're full of shit.
Here's the question though. Like, why, if the stakes are as high as you say they are, why do you think they're full of shit?
Rhetoric doesn't mean anything. The French have been talking a massive game on, okay, Germans and the French have been talking a massive game on Ukraine. So
no,
they haven't been.
The French have not been talking a massive.
That's not true. While they've been pursuing a diplomatic thing, they have still said domestically, they are 100% with Ukraine. This is a war against Europe. This is a battle against autocracy. They haven't sent shit to Ukraine. Even the UK, which is the most hawkish member of the EU, or okay, of the European continent. I keep saying EU. That's a funny one. That's stuck in my head. The UK.
You came up in 2010. You're never going to let it go.
Yeah, it's true.
You're like a guy who always says Czechoslovakia. You know, like that. Yeah. This is like your brain.
All right. So the UK, okay. Talk. Oh my God. Ukraine, Boris Johnson and his trip. It sent 1/10 the amount of material the United States has sent. You think they're going to, and that's in their own fucking backyard. You think they're going to send weapons to Taiwan? Never. Here's the other thing. These people are already, if you think our industry is bad on China, we make them look like the most hawkish isolationist people on earth. We had to have a massive fight with the UK, with the conservative government, to not let Huawei run their 5G. By the way, we only won that fight in the UK. They still have tremendous power. France, Germany, the Chinese economic power and sway over the European continent. If you think what's happening right now with Germany and natural gas is bad, think about that times 10. So no, I don't believe the French or the Germans, or I don't think NATO or any of the EU countries, fucking Montenegro, Finland, Sweden, will do jack shit when it comes to Taiwan. I think the only people we can truly stand with are the Australians, the Japanese, the South Koreans, the Singaporeans, mostly because they have seen the fight for, or the actual fight for what it is. Their economies aren't as impacted, more existential threat. And this is, look, I think it'll be a deeply, deeply clarifying situation about who our real allies are. I still don't know if this will happen in Taiwan. It could happen anywhere, but the time will come and it will be shown.
And look, like, you know, as we're wrapping, like the way I'm thinking about this is the Taiwanese, like a conflict in Taiwan is different than a conflict of Russia in Ukraine, because obviously it's a naval conflict. So much of that war isn't deterred.
You can't predict that though. It starts that way. You know, who knows?
That's actually like the point. Like the question for the US and Taiwan isn't like, can we airdrop in javelins after the Chinese take the island? The question in Taiwan is, would a US aircraft carrier battle group, would US F-35s and F-18s from and F-22s from Okinawa intervene if the Chinese launch an invasion?
See, like I think the answer to that question is no under all administrations that are realistically going to get elected. The real question is, what are you going to do when Japan and other powers insert themselves into the conflict, which we are treaty bound in order to support? I don't think that will
happen. Why is it a no?
What you're describing. I just don't see that under Joe Biden, under Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump is on record saying, quote, there isn't a fucking thing we can do about it. He's probably going to be the next president of the United States. Joe Biden says that we'll stand with Taiwan, all of this. But given his approach to the Ukraine conflict, which is really much like ally centric, I think almost anything that would any defense would not be U.S. led, quote unquote. It would be very much from the Asians in the first place. Like if the idea that we would be the first line of defense without any sort of like major coalition, I just don't think that's going to happen at all.
Well, I mean, difference here is that like the U.S. Navy is paramount in the Asia Pacific. So like the contrast between let me put it this way. The real difference here is that Russia, a conflict with China over Taiwan would really have to do with like international waters in those periods. That's different than like the dilemma facing the Biden administration, in Ukraine specifically. I think that everything you're describing, the dissatisfaction, the like, oh, it's just like rhetoric. Like, I think that rhetoric getting there is actually part of the process. And if there was a Chinese invasion tomorrow, I don't think we're there. But this is always going to be an issue. It's played out over the next 3, 4, 5, 6, even 10 years.
I know we're wrapping up, but my counter is that the rhetoric is actually counterproductive, has made it so that probably Taiwan is less. By the way, if half the point was supporting Ukraine so they wouldn't invade Taiwan, well, congratulations on that one. We just blew like an economic missile for, again, you know, and now the Ukrainians are fighting for, they say they're not going to give up until they get Crimea back. Like, I wasn't aware that we signed up for this policy position and that apparently that's the aim on which we're going to support the Ukrainian government, because that has not been longstanding U.S. policy up until this point. And that's exactly what I'm saying, which is that, you know, we've opened ourselves up to this fucking whole sink for decades, most likely, over there, and used up all of these economic missiles, by the way, of which the Chinese are well aware, have studied, and are now hardening their economy in order to make sure that such events will never work against them. And then should the time ever come, I think it'll probably be both less effective and we're unable. And this is Bridge Colby's point, which I think he's 100% correct about, which is that we are acting like we're in the position where you can have your cake and eat it too. And that ship sailed since probably 2003. And I just don't think that any, like the rhetoric, this is my pushback. The rhetoric is counterproductive. The rhetoric leads to the sinkhole in Ukraine, to the inability to cut them off, and also ask Zelensky why he's firing people for no apparent reason. We don't have that right now. And things are moving in such a fast direction that what you're talking about is like a 10-year project. I don't think we have 10 years. No way. I think we have like 3, maybe 4.
And I think the key thing though is, I think people are aware of that dynamic. And I do also think like that conversation, the reason why I'm optimistic on this is Xi is doing every single thing he can to harden the coalition against him. My bet, because ultimately like all these political things are bet, my bet is that effectively the U.S. is going to have to respond. And if the U.S. responds, Japan will respond. And like, that's like the underlying thing. And look, like we'll sadly, like this may be tested, but I just think that's the underlying dynamic. She has done every single thing he can to do it. And look, like at underlying level too, like our real disagreement on Ukraine and where it's valued is like, I'm like approaching this more from like the center left perspective on it. I think a world where Democrats weren't having to think of U.S. hard power as a good, positive thing. If we put it this way, the fact that like HIMARS, like the U.S. artillery we gave to the Ukrainians, weren't so incredibly effective in Ukraine, I think that's actually what you need to have happen to get Democrats to be serious about defense spending. I actually think it was really, really, really essential that you not just have this be the next sort of, what is it, domino to fall after what happened in Afghanistan.
Well, we'll see. We don't know yet whether that's going to happen. And, you know, look, I'm just saying, if China invades Taiwan after pumping $40 billion into Ukraine, then that is about the worst deterrence argument that has ever been made. And unfortunately, I think that's probably going to become true. And I will say it would have been a massive waste and was highly detrimental as a result. I mean, I just think it's undeniable that you can look on the battleground in Ukraine right now and not say that they are blowing all everything that we're giving to them. Meanwhile, putting out this insane propaganda.
I don't think you could say that.
I mean, look, they've literally lost in the Donbass. They have completely failed in any sort of offensive capabilities so far. They've launched it 3 weeks ago. Now they've launched this, putting out all these videos, acting as if bombing certain ammo depots in Crimea is like some big thing that we should sign up for. And second, who signed off on that? Because again, U.S. policy, at least for the last 7 years, has been to basically de facto recognize that Crimea is part of the Russian Federation. I'm not saying I support that. I'm just saying that's been de facto U.S. policy. So is that what we're giving them arms for? Like, to what end is all of this being employed? That's my point, which is that in terms of the battlefield, outside of limited defense of the capital, there has no been true military victory that has been achieved here. And if anything, we are now committed to cutting blank checks to, again, a deeply corrupt nation. Unfortunately, I'd say this is an unfortunate thing for decades now to come. There's just no wrap up on this. And I don't think there's any person who can look at the conflict and say otherwise. Like, the most biggest Ukraine hawks are saying that it's going to be a long war now. It's a war of attrition.
We've always said that, though. Like, that's always, like, as a Ukraine hawk, like, yeah, the standard party line.
What's the point? So what's the point? It's $100 billion for Ukraine for 10 years to protect the security of Donbass. So oil can continue to be $100.
The key thing here isn't to say that, like, $100 billion to Ukraine forever and no questions asked and Zelensky could fire whoever he wants.
But we haven't asked any questions, Marshall. And all of that has happened. And he continues to get more weapons and continues to get more money.
Once again, we're only 6 months into the war. All I am saying is so for example, you're saying like a 10-year commitment. That's just like not clear now. And I would just say,
clear as day.
What do you mean that it's a 10-year war and it's $100 trillion forever?
No, I think it's clear that 10 years he will have the political capital in Washington to get and do whatever he wants. I believe that. Absolutely. And I think that's unfortunate. I think it's a huge problem for the United States.
Look, like I said, the war with Taiwan is going to come down to whether or not the U.S. chooses to, like, have a naval intervention in a Taiwanese invasion. That's not going to come down to what we did in Ukraine. That's just not.
Yeah, but it could detract from it, and it will detract from it if it does happen.
Question. Like,
I just talked about U.S. defense stocks, about the amount of political capital, about our economic sanctions, about so much of the stuff that we blew our wad on for Ukraine. I mean, look, you only get a bite at the apple really one time. And once somebody knows that you have it, you can't just use it again. All the SWIFT things, Chinese entanglement with the U.S. financial system, you think they're not studying all of that and making sure that none of that will be effective against them? By the way, most of it would not have been as effective as it was against Russia. But I mean, it's very clear. Also, I mean, I think our sanctions policy has been a complete disaster. It's been a massive failure,
the quick point here, though, is this isn't a land war. It's a 50-mile, 50
nautical
mile.
None of this has anything to do with land. This has to do with geostrategy.
But that's the point, though. This isn't like with Russia. Russia can literally bring hundreds of thousands of troops onto the border and invade a country. Like, that's it. And there is literally nothing the United States or Europe can do to place themselves between that invasion. Like, that is like the central strategic reality of Ukraine in February 2022. The difference is, when it comes to Taiwan, the Chinese have to cross 50 nautical miles as missiles, anti-sea, and possibly the US, Japanese, Australian, and once again, you could say the French are full of shit, but they've said they'll do it. Navies are standing in the woods, but once again, like, are standing in their ways. Those are fundamentally different realities. And look, like,
well, see, I think things will play out very differently from that. I just don't think that.
Why would it play out? But that's the.
Oh, I mean, because I just don't think the invasion will happen. I think what will happen is a quote unquote surrounding a quarantine. And then they'll say, you either have reunification or you don't. And if we're going to fight. And what, the U.S. is going to place itself in before there's an actual act of war? No way. That's not going to happen. So then that will lead to a major diplomatic question about what to do. I mean, look, these people aren't idiots. You think they're just going to go full hog? you know, on day one? Of course not. They have to set up some fake plebiscite that the Taiwanese would have to vote for. And in that situation, it will require threat of economic sanctions. I mean, there's no war in history that has happened in modern history where somebody has done it that way. They always have to have some fake claim of democratic legitimacy. I'm virtually certain that if things play, that's the way that they play. And there's just no way that a U.S. carrier is going to put itself in between a Chinese ship whenever they're doing, you know, quote unquote quarantine or whatever. It's just, I just don't believe that.
Yeah. I think
not for a second.
The underlying reality here is this will be a perpetually, I think these debates are interesting because it's a weird mix of what's happening on the ground with like prognostication. And those bits we won't know. And I would just say that I see, to quote Winston Churchill in the way that, you know, Liz Cheney quotes Abraham Lincoln, like I see a way through. And that doesn't mean that like that way through is guaranteed, but I think I see a way through here. And it's going to be a long haul. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be straightforward. This isn't like a World War II, you know, Band of Brothers redux, but I think there's something there. And I think folks are moving. I think the arguments, and once again, I started this by saying, I think the Biden administration has done a bad political job on this, but I think at an underlying reality, the paces are moving the way they need to pace. The question is speed, obviously, but Xi is doing every single thing he can to speed it up. Every single time the Chinese have a strategic choice in front of them, they screw it up. It was a screw up. It was a huge, like,
never underestimate the idiocy of the Chinese.
It was so stupid for them to say, Nancy Pelosi, you can't go. It was just pointless.
I think there's zero COVID policy. And their foreign minister saying 9/11 was an inside job and COVID.
Could you, that's going to be such a reference that like, if you're not on Twitter, maybe, what are you referring to with the foreign minister?
See, actually, I'm not 100% sure because the guy blocked me. I'm actually blocked by this.
I'll tell you, I saw
CCP
it.
It's foreign ministry. I don't know what he said, but.
So it's Balaji talked about this, but for whatever reason, there's been this, people have started to note this like interesting phenomenon because Chinese, either people associated like with Chinese like publications and like a Chinese publication is invariably like a outlet of the CCP and Chinese foreign military officials like have been very, very, very aggressive rhetorically. What they do is this is called wolf warrior diplomacy. It's in reference to the wolf warrior series of two movies. We talked about this with Eric Swartzel back in February. But the point is they're just very, very, very aggressive. And the meme that was put out was it showed, it's that format of like, it's a very outdated format, but it was how Iraq sees America. And then it's like a burning thing in Baghdad, how Libya sees America, a burning thing in Baghdad, on and on and on and on, Vietnam, all the different ones, how America sees itself. And it's Superman, Reeves, Christopher Reeves is Superman, what America actually is. And it's the two towers burning. What it actually does, right? And the point is, he was saying like the U.S. did 9/11, and
I was trying to find it while you were talking.
The thing is, they're what they don't understand, and they is like a charged word, but I mean the Chinese foreign ministry is that their attacks are just so bad faith that it just like doesn't work. So for example, you'll see like, you remember they tried to be woke during COVID?
Yeah. Where they're like, when they said it was the U.S. military that blamed that? They're like, actually, it was the U.S. military which released COVID. And we were all like, yeah, fuck you. Yeah.
It's funny. Like, there was this Chinese, this is my favorite one because, like, it's like when someone sees like a different language and tries to, they were trying to counter, you know, Uyghur genocide rhetoric. And they go, oh, well, if you look at Anacostia, D.C., right, the African American population is actually like severely impoverished. So who's the real ethnic genocider? And it's kind of just like, dude, like that is like, dude, obviously
people in your country literally live in caves. It's not an exaggeration. People should read about this. It's actually kind of interesting. There are like 50 million people in China who live in a cave.
I didn't know this.
I mean, China's huge, but there's like all these people in China that live in caves and like hunt for their food. It's crazy. It's actually totally crazy. Yeah.
So yeah, let's just put it this way. This is what you and I can agree on and finish up with.
Yeah.
Never underestimate the CCP's ability to just make really bad judgment calls, and B, the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs is just not good at making arguments. Because actually, you know this, like when you come from an authoritarian culture, you just like, they have not been trained to actually like win debates. There is no, there are debates in China. So if you're like Xi going into like the, you know, party Congress in November, there's going to be a lot of internal debate, but there's never public debate. If you're a Chinese like Ministry of Foreign Affairs person, there is no danger that if you misprecisely tweet something, people within your own country will quote tweet and dunk on you. You have no training in just how to like argue and do those different bits. And it speaks to one of those like weird, like, democracy has trouble, but it's better than the other systems when it comes to certain things. We will leave it there. Lots of topics, lots of debate. Hope you all enjoy this. Like, once again, if you have made it to this point in the episode and you do not already subscribe to the Realignment Supercast, you are not doing yourself or us a favor. We have access to our Spotify data. Genuinely, like these last 30 seconds, like this is where like 20% of listeners have made it this far. So if you've made it this far and you enjoy the show, realignment.supercast.com. We appreciate the support and are excited to keep building. Sagar, thank you for joining me on The Realignment.
Thanks, guys. See you later.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.